Hello there and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And for this special edition of the Weekly, we're going long on the Austrian maximalist Anton Bruckner. Bruckner's symphonies are currently the subject of a mini-cycle at the National Concert Hall, where tonight the RTE NSO is performing his 8th symphony. But which version? And we'll also meet the young Dublin ensemble Glasshouse, who may or may not be the 21st century incarnation of a show band. But first, a very important and at the same time completely rhetorical question. How do you solve a problem like Anton? In 1969, the musicologist Derek Cook first published an influential but basically unreadable essay on the Austrian composer Anton Bruckner. It was called The Bruckner Problem, simplified. Misleading title. And even though Cook revised the piece for a 1975 version, he never quite put the problem to bed. The problem being, ironically, the proliferation of alternative versions of Bruckner's symphonies, some rewritten by the self-doubting composer, some edited, and some even expanded by friends. Irish composer Dave Flynn has recently been doing some deep listening on the catalogue of Bruckner symphonies, where the Bruckner problem is amplified by the new takes generations of conductors and orchestras have offered. Flynn brought his MacBook, all but capsizing under the weight of digital variants, to Culture File Towers for some simplification. So how do you hold a moonbeam in your hand?
34 different scores for the 9 symphonies exist in the composer's own hand and those of others. Only the 5th and the 6th are free of such intervention. Derek Cook, he was an English kind of scholar and primarily an expert on Mahler's music, and he is most famous perhaps for finishing Mahler's 10th symphony. But he also had a great interest in Bruckner, and he wrote this essay in 1970 called The Bruckner Problem Simplified.
So he was announcing the problem and simplifying it all at once?
Well, yes, but I guess the problem was known. Any conductor or any programmer who came to Bruckner's music had this problem from the beginning. So a conductor coming wanting to, say, do the 3rd or the 8th symphony, well, what edition did they choose, you know, and which is the most authentic one? Is there an authentic one? It seems to be mainly down to Bruckner being a very, very humble guy. You know, he was kind of prone to a lot of self-doubt and he would take criticism. So, say, the 3rd symphony, when it was premiered, it was a disastrous premiere. He was conducting and most of the audience walked out by the end. Interestingly, Mahler was in the audience and he stayed and he loved it and he became a big fan of Bruckner. But when these kind of things happened, Bruckner just felt, oh, this isn't good enough, I'll have to revise it. And sometimes the problem was not necessarily Bruckner, it was the conservative audience in Vienna at the time. It may seem strange now listening to Bruckner because his style has been copied so much. It influenced so many composers. You hear Bruckner sound in Hollywood movies, in Star Wars, Lord of the Rings.
You can hear, even in the earlier pieces, say in the 3rd symphony, this kind of thing that he was famous for, this kind of car crash. He just piles huge banks of string into each other in a kind of like reckless driving kind of way. Yeah. And you'd imagine that must be slightly disturbing for your audience.
Yeah, well, you can imagine in the late 19th century what it was like. You know, we're talking about a time when Wagner's music was kind of controversial then, and it's not long after some of Beethoven's music was causing audiences confusion and took a while to be accepted.
One of the things that all this confusion around what is the right version and who helped him with this piece and who made cuts and even rewrote sections is the idea of the kind of lone genius sort of disappears a little bit, because we feel like those big symphonies, at least in a lot of versions, are actually quite collaborative works.
Yeah. Well, I think with Bruckner pieces, most of the major changes were done by himself. So the Haas edition of the 8th Symphony, he merged bits of an 1887 and an 1890 version of the score by Bruckner. So he's taking thoughts of Bruckner from different versions and kind of imagining his own version of it. And he also added in a few things himself there.
So you've got your laptop in front of you there, and it is loaded up with the infinite Bruckner playlist, and you're going to show us some of the things that matter when we're working out which is the version we want.
Yeah, well, that is the question. What is the version you want? Like, the Fourth Symphony is probably the most problematic there, because he went through quite a lot of revisions, and the original version has completely different pieces. The scherzo movement, the third movement, is completely different. In terms of Bruckner, one of his most famous pieces is the scherzo in the better known later edition of the Fourth Symphony. And this is, I'll play at the start of this. They call this is kind of the hunting scherzo. It's like depicting a hunt. So that was Daniel Barenboim and the Berlin Philharmonic. And then the original version, which we have now, Simone Jung and the Hamburg Philharmonic. This is the scherzo, the opening of the scherzo. Completely different piece.
Absolutely different.
And the pieces are for the 12 minutes 45 of Simone Jung's one and the 10 minutes 23 of Barenboim's one. They're completely different pieces, literally. In the original version, there's more reference to the general theme of the full symphony. Like, say, here's the opening movement of the original version. So you just hear that opening and then go back to this. This is Simone Jung's version with the Hamburg Philharmonic. And this is the Urfassung original version from 1874. So that's just a little kind of almost like a reference back to the first movement, to kind of a slow kind of horn call. Whereas when he revised it and did the new scherzo, the hunting, that's kind of not there. So people who kind of endorse the original version say that as good as this hunting scherzo is, it's maybe not as organically connected to the symphony as a whole. But then on the other hand, I've read some people say that the original scherzo movement is one of the weakest of Bruckner's scherzos. So it's all personal preference, you know.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the Eighth.
The Eighth Symphony. Oh, you're catching me there. The history of the Eighth Symphony.
Who's it by?
This is like his biggest symphony. A performance can last an hour and a half. Could be longer depending on the conductor. Celibidache, the Romanian conductor, is famous for really slowing the symphonies down, and he creates this really spacious kind of thing, and that's controversial. Some people love it, some people hate it. The Eighth Symphony, the first version was completed in 1887, and then there's the Novak edition of that, probably the most widely played. And then he did in 1888, there was an adagio, reworking of the adagio movement. Then in 1990, there was the second version, again comes out in a Novak edition. There's actually other editions too. Haas did his edition in 1939, which is the one that combined the 1887 and the 1890 versions. And then in 1892, there was a published edition by Haslinger, Schleslinger and Lienau. So there's all these different versions to draw from.
What are the distinctions in the versions then?
The main one, which makes a huge difference, is the ending of the first movement. I'll play the more common version first. This is Barenboim with Berlin Philharmonic. Common ending that you'd hear, unless you were at an event which advertised the original version. That's what you can expect. It really helps the symphony grow, I think, to have it end, the first movement end like that, because usually Bruckner's first movements end in quite a big sound, and so this was kind of unusual for him to just kind of peter it out. But because it's such a long symphony, it sets it up and it gives you the sense of the tragic of the kind of mood of it, of being pensive and not the big happy ending. A bit ambiguous of an, you know, it's kind of an ambiguous ending. It sets up what's coming next. You know, you're kind of like, you know, there's more to come and a lot more to come. Here, I'll play you the ending with Simone Jung. So what we're going to hear is a bit of what we've just heard, but then it just builds up. Again, to just, it seems like out of nowhere, let's put in a big ending. It's completely new music. The revised version that we just heard, it just ends pretty much similarly to what we're going to hear towards the end of the Eighth Symphony, the original version. You're getting similar kind of music. But then in the original score, you just get this big orchestral kind of... Completely different mood. It ends the first movement of the symphony in a completely different way. And the advocates for the revised version, and I would tend to agree with them, would be that this kind of big ending in the original version kind of takes away from the final ending of the full piece, you know? When you don't have that ending and you kind of peter out like in the more familiar version, you're still kind of waiting for that huge climax. And if we just play, say, the climax of the whole symphony, you haven't heard something quite like this throughout the symphony. And after 90 minutes, especially live with a great orchestra and a great conductor, after 90 minutes, this ending is just one of the most hair-raising things in orchestral music.
What we get from different versions there, this is two versions that are both created by Bruckner. Yeah. And one of them, he's written an ornate and dense piece of music, but then just decided that's not the place for it.
Yeah, so when Bruckner first presented his first version of the symphony, he presented it to the conductor Herman Levi, who rejected it as unplayable. Apparently, it sent Bruckner into a pretty big depression, and he revised it considerably then, because he had just actually, not long after, had the first really great symphonic triumph of his life when the Seventh Symphony was premiered, and it was really well received, and he had faced a life of almost rejection for his symphonic work, or confusion, and he had this great high of that, and then this crushing kind of defeat, so it caused him to revise it. And maybe that feeling pervaded the new version of the symphony, taking out the triumphal ending of the first movement and making it a kind of a more solemn ending.
Does it harm him overall that so many of the pieces are considered sort of malleable in some way, that they've been changed so many times that it feels like anybody's intervention is worth something?
I think the Bruckner problem as a whole probably does harm Bruckner's reception. He is considered a great composer and a great symphonic composer, but there might be a resistance to place him among the top rank, partly because the pieces are so long and they're difficult for anyone, unless you get really into it, to just sit through a 90-minute symphony. Who has time for that, you know? You could listen to 7 Haydn symphonies in the same time. Some of Bruckner's symphonies have subtitles on them, and this is subtitled The Apocalyptic Symphony. It does have this sense of doom and foreboding, you know. To actually see a really good performance of it is life-affirming in a way, even though it's apocalyptic, you know. Because it does actually have a really uplifting ending, I think. You know, it goes through all this turmoil, and it's almost like it's a crisis of faith or something, or was it just a crisis of life, or he's fighting something anyway, and then it's resolved gloriously in the end. If we can narrow it down, there might be two types of composers in the world. There's the ones who are very, this is the way it has to be done. They put all the explicit instructions. They have one version of their score. This is how it has to be done. And then there are others who are more flexible. And some people would say maybe unsure, maybe Bruckner was unsure, but maybe he was also just open to ideas. And you'd find out with, you know, you can be working with a performer, send them a piece of music, and because notation and instructions are so open to interpretation, they will come and interpret it in a way that you weren't expecting. I had that recently with a piece, and the performer did something I would have never done, but I quite liked it, you know. And it wasn't necessarily in the score to do it like that, but it was kind of like, oh, yeah, it's a good option.
Dave Flynn there on Shades of the Bruckner Problem, and the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, with Michael Gertz conducting, will be performing Bruckner's Symphony No. 8, the 1887-90 Haas, for Dave Flynn and all the Bruckner nerds, in approximately 12 minutes' time at the NCH in Dublin. But if you're not in the car park at Earlsford Terrace by now, no panic. Paul Herriot and the Lyric Concert will be along as soon as the Culture File Weekly ends with a live broadcast of the Big 8. So just stay put. And if you're listening to the podcast, you can stream that concert from the RTE Lyric FM website anytime you like. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, where did all the show bands go? Okay, I'm not really sure I have an answer to that question, but let's meet Glasshouse, a Dublin outfit best known for playing music made famous by others. Only the music they play skews contemporary classical, the odd sortie into Bon Iver and Sufjan Stevens notwithstanding. Glasshouse first came together to perform the music of Oliver Arnold's in a live setting, and have since also reanimated music from the likes of Johan Johansson and Max Richter. Most recently, they've invited emerging contemporary composers to write new works for them. This weekend, they play Spike Alternative Cello Festival at a new Dublin venue, Lost Lane. Ornya Gallagher went to meet Glasshouse's founders to talk new music, new venues, and a new world of cello.
We're approaching music that very often isn't performed by other groups, music that for some reason doesn't quite fit into many barriers. So, but we find that it's music that people are really interested in hearing, and music that me, Michael, and all of the players in the group really enjoy listening to themselves and haven't had the experience or the opportunity to perform that kind of music before. I'm Nisha Dak, and I am violinist and artistic director of Glasshouse.
I'm Michael Stone, and I'm producer and manager of Glasshouse.
Glasshouse is a new music group that founded in 2015, and we're an ensemble of varying size, varying instruments that likes to put on concerts in novel locations and perform music that often isn't being performed right now.
Nisha approached me a couple of years ago. We've been friends for years, but I had been producing theatre productions for a little while, and Nisha got in touch with an idea for a concert. He wanted to put on Oliver Arnold's second album, And They Escaped the Weight of Darkness, and we wanted to do it somewhere really special, so we did it in the Pepper Canister Church. And when we put it together, we put a name on it, on the ensemble, and called it Glasshouse, and we put on that concert, and it went down really well. It was a good success, and we kind of took it from there then.
Recently, we performed the music of another minimalist composer, Johan Johansson. He had recently deceased. And again, this is another composer we had all been really, really interested by, and his music had a great effect on many of us. So we got in touch with his managing estate and asked if we could reimagine some of his music and do a performance of it, and they agreed. This proved to be a good opportunity for us to get some new music commissioned for the ensemble, for the same ensemble that we would have that night. So we commissioned five Irish composers to write a piece of music that was a response to the work and the life of Johan Johansson in some way or another. So Rachel Lavelle's piece is minimalist and salsa. For the instrumentation was string quintet with a cello and a pre-recorded tape part that she made herself, which is a conversation with a friend of hers called Gerardo. Interestingly enough, she was just getting him to say things via WhatsApp voice messages. She also made a sound design of electronics to go with it as well. I'd say it's minimalist in style. The harmony is quite open fifths, open fourths, quite indicative of minimalist stuff. There's uses of different kind of extended techniques. So you can hear some circular bowing, some harmonics. And yeah, it's a cool piece. We really liked performing it. Loro sono.
Getting back to just the venue side of things, you've had a lot of experience with approaching venues and searching out alternative venues that might be used as performance spaces.
Yeah, I suppose it's always something that we try and seek out at unique venues for each concert. So it's always a little bit of a hunt and a little bit of a mission to try and find something different. There are a lot of challenges with finding unique venues, you know, with booking insurance specifically for the event, hiring gear and PA for the concerts, that just kind of increase the overheads for the concerts when it comes to kind of using, you know, non-traditional concert venues. So there are challenges in that sense. I think, you know, I mean, I've been putting on events in Dublin since I was in university, so it's coming on, you know, 5 or 6 years since I started putting on events. It has gotten more difficult over the past couple of years, I think. Finding venues that haven't been appropriated by the corporate world is a bit of a challenge. Like, a lot of the venues that we would have seen kind of being very open to musical concerts and not as interested in it. It's become more and more of a challenge, I think, and every time we go on the hunt, it does get harder, and it does seem like there's a dwindling stock of alternative venues available for concerts like this. But we're going to keep on looking and keep on trying each time we put one on, you know.
Yeah, so speaking of new venues, actually, we're about to play in Lost Lane, which is part of Bike Cello Fest. So our brief was when we were approached by Mary and Leoba, the two artistic directors and founders of the festival, was to, I suppose, kind of do our thing, but make it very cello-focused. So we're lucky because we've happened to play with four different wonderful cellists anyway. For this concert, yeah, we have four cellos in the band, which is great. And we're playing a concert, I suppose, mainly of minimalism. We're playing some music by Johan Johansson, Olaf Arnolds, Max Richter, that we've kind of reimagined into cello-heavy ensemble with there'll be a violin, viola, and keys and electronics as well. But we've kind of reimagined it slightly so that a lot of the, say, first violin melodies are now in the cello, and the cellos are definitely the shining light of this concert. And then we've also commissioned some new arrangements, which we're super excited about. So we're playing some music by Mika Levy, who is a fantastic film composer, a piece from her score, Under the Skin. Also, we're playing some music by Hilde Grötner, who, again, is an Icelandic minimalist composer. She's quite famous at the moment because she just won a Grammy the other day for The Joker, and she's the first female film composer to be nominated for an Oscar. Should be a really exciting concert, and I can't wait to see four cellos on stage. That's gonna be great.
Glasshouse there talking to Áine Gallagher, and Glasshouse play Spike Cello Festival on Sunday night at Lost Lane with support from the cello duo Two Verses. SpikeCelloFest.com for details of all the weekend's bowing. And Glasshouse play the music of Aphex Twin on Friday the 28th of February at Dublin's Sugar Club. And that brings to a shuddering halt this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more dark imaginings via iTunes, Spotify and all your usual apps, as well as through the very air itself on RTE Lyric FM next Friday at 7. Till then, bye now.